is go through in boring and painstaking detail. No, we're going to go through the OFS Blended Learning Review. And there's a few reasons for that. So, look, in and of itself, it's an important piece of work that is going, obviously, particularly in England, to have quite a significant impact, I think, across the sector when friends and colleagues in higher education read it. But really quite specifically, I think, for students' unions, there are, you know, there are some important things that kind of come out of it that tell us how OFS is going to regulate, and also I think help to inform the way that students' unions might kind of talk to course reps in the year ahead, develop their relationship with course reps and so on. I guess the other thing about this is that, you know, blended learning remains a kind of really thorny, tricky issue. On lots of the kind of catch-up calls that me and that there Olivia do with subscriber students' unions, blended learning is a kind of topic of discussion. There are still universities that are kind of evaluating what they've done and where they go next. And, you know, I mean, it remains the case that lots of universities are kind of torn, I think, between approaches that should try to get people kind of back onto campus, because apparently that's what the surveys say and it's good for belonging and so on, but also approaches that are good for accessibility and that ensure that not just students that have kind of got used to being able to do lots of stuff online, but also students that perhaps might argue that they need to do lots of stuff online are able to do you know, more stuff remotely or asynchronously or online or whatever it might be. And certainly so far, you know, lots of the debate around this stuff has been relatively kind of binary reductive, you know, is online better than face-to-face and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, to the extent to which anywhere, some people have said, oh, well, what you have to do is you have to have a mixture of online and in-person. And actually, it's just as easy to argue that if you've traveled a million, you know, if you traveled halfway around the world to be in the UK, even an hour of teaching online in your room in halls is a bit of a waste of time. But also, if you really, really need, you know, to be working full time, perhaps, you know, cost of living crisis has been downturn in the economy or whatever, the every hour of teaching that is kind of needlessly in a lecture theatre is also a waste of time. So, you know, that debate hasn't really moved, I'll be honest, since June 2020. And one of the things that the OFS document does, the review process and then the resultant OFS document, is move the debate on a bit in a kind of really helpful way. I don't say this very often about the Office for Students, but it's a good piece of work, this. Let's start with a bit of context then. Do students care about this sort of stuff? Well, just under a third of students said they got poor or very poor value for money in 21-22. Okay, that's your start point. That's the Advanced HE HEPI Student Academic Experience Survey. And the second most cited factor explaining that view, behind the cost, but ahead of the volume of in-person or online teaching, although that was there next, if you like, so volume of in-person or online, was teaching quality. And obviously, given that, you know, lots of teaching and learning was being done online, according to other results in the Student Academic Experience Survey, OFS has said, this is a nice way of putting it, I think, the survey may suggest that blended approaches to teaching and learning are not considered by a significant proportion of students to be of sufficiently high quality. There's a phrase. So what it did is it's done a review. Now the first thing to say is, in a way, what this review and this process is doing is harking back to and explaining and qualifying and giving examples of this new thing called the OFSB conditions. So in England, used to have this thing called the quality code. We now have this thing called OFSB conditions. This is the minimum quality required of all programs and all higher education providers. We've done a number of kind of webinars and briefings about this. And generally what I would say is that they are more kind of detailed and granular on minimum expectations than we have perhaps seen in the past from the QAA quality code. Five areas of these B conditions. Academic experience, that is what you think it is. Resources and support, so that's kind of support for students outside of the classroom, if you like. If you think of B1 as being in the classroom and B2 as being the, you know, kind of resources and support for students outside the classroom, I do. Student outcomes, B3, the B3 bear, talks about that a lot. This is the getting to the second year, completing the course, getting a graduate job, rates, okay? And then assessment and awards, this is, again, that's what you think it is. And then qualification standards is, kind of comparable sector agreed standards for a particular subject area or particular degree, so on. The two that are kind of really important, other than B3, which lots of people have been talking about, actually the three that are really important are 1, 2, and 4, because one is like your teaching, 2 is like, you know, is there anywhere to sit and is the library any good? And 4 is, you know, assessment and feedback, which we know lots of students get upset about. And the thing that's really interesting about the blended learning review is when these were published, these B conditions, they're a bit high level. I mean, I'm not, you know, I would say it's a smart thing to kind of introduce, certainly the whole officer team, definitely course reps, anyone else around that kind of is interested in education, I guess. Certainly advice, the advice team, if you've got one. People need to know the kind of B conditions, really. But the thing that's interesting about this exercise is what it's done is in the context of blended learning, it's kind of taken the headline B conditions and then remixed them in a bit of detail so they make sense in a blended learning context. And I have to say, a lot of it is really helpful outside of the strict blended learning debate and really helpful just generally from a sort of student rights perspective. And I'll explain as we go through the slides, as I kind of get there, the various moments where I sort of think that's the case. So, let me give you an example here. So B2, as I say, B2, if you remember back here, is about sufficient resources and support to enable student success, or words like that. Currently, in the B2 description, OFS back in May had a bit of a go at explaining what that might mean from a principled point of view. So it says, in relation to physical and digital learning resources, which is one of the types of resources that it can look at under B2, there's an illustrative non-exhaustive list of matters relating to digital learning resources that could fall within the definition. So, appropriate hardware. Students have or have reliable and consistent access to hardware that enables them to access course content. Software, ditto, got to have the software to access your course content, assignments or whatever. Students got to be able to access, I don't know, Adobe Photoshop if they're on a photography course or something. You know what I mean? Tech infrastructure, they got to work repaired quickly when needed. Reliable access to the internet. A trained teacher or instructor. That can do digital teaching and learning. Appropriate place to study. Students have consistent access to a quiet space that is appropriate for studying. There you go. That's a tricky one, isn't it, when we come up to exam time in some places. So that's an example of what OFS has kind of said, look, we've got this top line. There've got to be the resources and support to enable a student to succeed. And then later in B2's definition, it says, and here's what all the things that might mean. Now, the trouble with here's all the places, the things that that might mean. It's not a lot of detail. There's only so long you can make these documents. And again, as I say, what's interesting about this one is what they've done with blended learning is take blended learning and say, here's a kind of version of what you see on the slide now. Here's how B2 applies to blended learning. Same with B1, same with B4. And again, as I say, that's helpful from a blended learning perspective, but it's also a bit, it's helpful a bit more generally. So here's what they did. Back in March, April, May, whenever it was, OFS said, what we're going to do is we're going to put together a review panel to provide some academic judgments about what providers are doing on blended learning. So we'll get a bunch of academics. They can go and work that out. And then what we'll do as OFS is we'll say where those academic judgments relate to the regulation that OFS runs. So OFS has got a regulatory framework. It's got a bunch of academics over here. It sends the academics off to go and look at, I think it was six providers, blended learning stuff. They come back, they say, well, here's what we think academically. And OFS says, okay, well, let's translate that into our regulation. It's a little bit of controversy in that process. Certainly I was one of the people that was saying, it's a shame that none of those academic experts were students. So, you know, there's a rich tradition of some of the people making these judgments in review teams on quality being students. Now, they have tried very hard in the reports that have been published to stress all the different things that the OFS student panel did. They met students, they were thinking of students, they had a photo of a student on their wall, you know, all this stuff. It isn't the same as regarding students as experts. I will continue in principle to keep my view, which is to shame that OFS hasn't, you know, framed this review as an opportunity to have a students as experts. But nevertheless, this is the process they went through. So what they did is they toddle off with clipboards, these academics, to six different providers across the sector. They have managed, they say, across the six to somehow cover high, medium and low tariff. That's the grade you need to get in types of providers. They've both covered, they've done the gamut of size. So they reckon they've managed to include a large research intensive university and at least one small and specialist. And they reckon they've also covered different geographical spreads around England. In each provider, they looked at four subject areas, actually five, no, four. Humanities, medicine and allied health, natural sciences and engineering and performing arts. And they've done that because if you think about it, there's quite a, I mean, that's quite a, it's quite a mix. Yeah, you're getting a proper spread of provision, I guess, if you go for those different areas, different, you know. Teaching humanities is very different to teaching medicine. It's very different to performing arts, isn't it? So, you know, fair enough. They've gone for kind of different types of subject. The other thing, as I say, they've stressed they've talked to students. It doesn't say, it kind of pointedly doesn't say that they talked to the Students' Union. I think that's probably, that's probably a shame, arguably a mistake. You know, I'm sure in those providers, the Students' Union would have had some interesting and helpful things to say to the academics that were on the panel. But we are where we are. So it's great. It's a great bit of work. I never say this. It's a really good piece of work. So before we go through it, I mean, just to give you some headlines, highlights and previews. It talks about certainly the panel's report, you know, the academics that went off of clipboards. They've come back and said, well, you know, we've looked at things like the definitions of blended learning, where the decisions get made in a university. They've thought about where a university's been growing very quickly. It's a big topic at the moment in lots of places. Remember, this is a blended learning review that covers PGT and PGR, unlike the TEF. Communication with students, EDI, online lecture provision, digital skills, so that academics know what they're doing and aren't kind of mumbling their way through slides and getting Zoom wrong. You name it, it basically covers a lot of it, if that makes sense. So, you know, as I was getting a really quite helpful coverage, you know, quite comprehensive coverage. So what they've done is the panel goes off, as I say, it kind of writes up their report, then it brings it back to OFS in Bristol, and it says, and then OFS says, okay, where does all of this fit in our regulatory framework? And what OFS has done is think about that in three ways, which I'll come on to. It's published, OFS has published quite a long report, which is aimed at universities. I think arguably technically aimed also at students' unions, although it's turgid, it's very long as usual. It's one of the reasons why I'm literally doing this as we speak. The other thing it's done is what it's called a short online guide for students, parents, or interested members of the public, where it's almost gone too far t'other way in terms of simplicity, but there we are. And what that does is it explains to students what they can do if they've got concerns about their academic experience. But it's saying that, you know, anyone can read its long report as if they would. My general view on that is OFS has still got some distance to go in terms of understanding the appropriate way, I think, to interact with students and student unions, and to consider whether it's really interested in empowering students, student unions, and student representatives to kind of understand and then tackle issues that are within this kind of basket. But that's a different issue for a different day. Yes. Now, I won't go back through the B condition. I won't go back through B1, B2, and so on. But I am going to refer to them briefly, again, just to explain where everything fits together. And broadly, if you can get across this and get kind of used to handling this stuff, you are going to nail the discussions in university committees and when talking to reps and so on. By the way, if you've got this far in and you're from Wales, Scotland or Northern Ireland, there's a lot of stuff in here that's still very, very helpful from a blended learning perspective. And I say that because it's a group of academics that have done report one. If you like, the original report where the academics talk about what ought to be happening and the things they found and their concerns, it would be perfectly possible for someone at the Quality Assurance Agency to link that, the clipboard exercise, with the quality code. Clearly what OFS has done is link the clipboard exercise with OFS's quality conditions. But you know, you could just as easily do it with a quality code. And so I guess, you know, there will be a few moments over the next kind of, you know, 20 minutes or so where I'll talk about OFS's concerns. They don't apply in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. But the stuff that the academics thought was important from a blended learning experience, that very much does apply. And one of the things that I guess I would say, if you're having a kind of conversation about blended learning and where you kind of go next with it, if you're, as I say, if you're in Wales, Scotland or Northern Ireland, is maybe you're not going to use the OFS document very heavily, but it's well worth getting your head around, as I say, the original, we're a bunch of academics and we've gone out to look at provision document, because there's lots of kind of really helpful considerations and issues that they've highlighted. Now, B1, just as a reminder, B1 is academic experience. So as I say, It's like the course, it's the actual teaching, the course itself. And broadly, courses have to be up to date, coherent, efficiently delivered, and appropriate to the subject matter of the course, requires students to develop the right skills. A little bit more detail on B1 on the screen. Now, brilliantly, as I say, what OFS has done is it's taken a whole bunch of concerns from the clipboard people and then dropped them into where they fit under B1, as you can see on the screen here. So OFS says, for example, OFS would have compliance concerns if a provider used lecture recordings that weren't up to date or weren't appropriately informed by subject matter development, research, industrial professional developments, or developments in teaching and learning. So, you know, when students wander in and go, you won't believe, I mean, you know, on our course, they've reused last year's lecture recordings. If there's aspects of those lecture recordings that are no longer up to date, OFS would have concerns. So this is how OFS has done it. OFS has said, if you think about those B conditions, here's some aspects of the academic experience that we'd have concerns about that relate back to B1. Similarly, another five here. Lots of students, I think, during the pandemic were saying, lots of stuff's moved online. There's just too much to do. I feel overloaded. Effectively, the volume of recorded material and digital learning resources is now too high. OFS says, if that's the case, it would have concerns, okay, related again to the academic experience. We'll come back to some of those things. Secondly, then, in B2, so remember B1, the course, B2, support for students to succeed on the course. There's all the things about B2, high quality academic experience, resources, qualified staff, decent resources and support. And again, it's taken all the clipboard warrior stuff and dropped it into the categories in B2. So, for example, OFS says it would be worried if students weren't getting adequate access to appropriate physical spaces that allow them to access and engage with digital learning. And I guess we can all think of potentially some students who've said, you know, they just don't have appropriate physical spaces that allow them to access and engage with digital learning. Again, if you look down there, you'll see potentially a familiar list of concerns either that students did have, or perhaps more concerningly, they still have. And if that's the case, we'll kind of come on to what people should do. Another five here, again, that relate to B2. Let's have a look at, I don't know. The first one on there is the most obvious, I guess, where lots of students, I think, certainly in the first part of the pandemic, were saying that their academics didn't really know how to use the tech. Really an excuse for that anymore. Okay. So, again, we'll explain how they work, where they come in, and so on. And then finally, C1, consumer protection law. So B1, the course, B2, support for students to succeed. And then C1, by the way, there's a bit of B4 in here, but I won't go into too much detail. C1 is consumer protection law. Universities have to ensure their information is clear, provide students with sufficiently detailed information about how courses will be delivered. OFS would be worried if a provider can't demonstrate it's kind of done that stuff. Again, I'll kind of explain that in a bit when we get there. So B1, these are your big areas. B1, B2, C1. B1, academic experience. B2, resources and support. C1, consumer protection. Make the right promises. Keep your promises. Okay. B3 is outcomes, of course. B4 is assessment. But this review is mainly about 1, 2 and C1. Okay. If you can get to a point where your course reps are familiar with and talking the language of B1, B2, C1 and so on, you're doing really well. And again, you know, one of the things I said, I've said a couple of times on the site and I've said to various people, is over the past year when I've been sort of starting to talk to reps at kind of rep conferences and so on about the B conditions and getting them to start thinking about what they experience on their course in relation to what OFS says, their eyes light up, they get more animated, they start to understand what their role is supposed to be. And crucially, really important, reps start to make judgments rather than just collecting gobbets of feedback. And the that thing about making judgments, reps evaluating programs, really important kind of framing, gives them a bit more power, makes them feel a bit more assertive, and different in framing, I think, to this idea of voice per se, because it moves us into course evaluation, students evaluating their experience and then making suggestions to improve their experience, which is a bit different to I'm just representing the views of students. So a helpful, I think, you know, kind of move on from that kind of pure I just represent the views of students voice thing. So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to go into massive detail on each of the areas. What I would say about each of the areas, just to flick back, you could do no harm, I think, by taking that list under B1 from a blended learning point of view, which is these two slides, and then also this list under B2, which is those two slides, and then this one, which is a long-winded way of saying make the right promises and keep the promises. And I've got a simpler way of describing that in a few slides time. Could do a lot worse than finding a way to kind of talk to reps about that in course rep training. As I say, it's probably quite important that advice staff understand this stuff, that there's a long running conversation, I think, about where educational, where programs are below this kind of mandated OFS minimum. Is that a voice thing in a student union? You know, is it an advice thing? You know, that you know, as I've said to lots of people, that probably needs kind of sorting in the round. But as many people as possible, I think it would do no harm to kind of understand, as I say, the way these kind of new minimums play out. So what I've done is on the next, as I say, 15 minutes or so slides, is try to summarise some of the really interesting stuff that OFS has done with the clipboard. So as I say, clipboards come in, relate it to OFS regulation, describe how that works then for providers. As I say, I've tried to pick some of the kind of highlights from all of that. So this first area is on decision making. Now, lemon Fanta. decision making. Really interestingly, if you read the actual report, the main report, it says that basically students at one of the providers they went to were really upset about the sheer volume of recorded lectures that they had to watch, right? And basically they said, you know, if you look at the amount of stuff we've been given, there's no way it would fit into a face-to-face timetable, and we're falling behind. And, you know, broadly, they'd ended up in this position because they happened to have chosen particular modules. Now, what the review panel found is that the decision about the kind of balance between online and in person was basically all being left to module leaders. And overall, the panel decided you can't just leave it to module leaders and not have a kind of wider discussion. That would make the course incoherent. It feels all over the place. Really interesting decision, because so many people I talk to, you know, they experience that kind of, you know, it's all decided at the module level. So here you go. This is another way of putting what I've just said. The panel highlighted a variety of ways in which providers manage and describe their blended approach, setting different levels of autonomy for decisions about the approach at different levels within their organizational structures. The panel's view was that if you devolve it to module level, you've got to be coherent at a course level. Can't just let module leaders do whatever they want. That would mean in condition B1, that the course wasn't being effectively delivered. I mean, there's a few other bits in there. So, you know, they found one course where, you know, the academics were like, we'd quite happily teach this face to face, but we've been told we have to have a certain percentage online. And, the clipboard panel people went, hold on, you can't just have a fixed percentage. That doesn't make sense. You have to do the right balance for the right reasons. sound pedagogical reasons. But it's that kind of thing, really, where what they're saying is, you know, you can't just leave these to individual module leaders. The implication, of course, is that there are similar things when you're not just talking about blended, where there's too much power given to individual module leaders and the decisions they make aren't coherent or linked into a kind of pattern across a course that gives, that would give OFS cause for concern. So, so you know, again, you know, the read across from some of these things. Okay. So that's that. Now, probably a much more important one for many people, that certainly that with me and that Olivia have been speaking to over the past few weeks, is number growth. So one of the things the panel found was hugely increased student numbers and quite significant space constraints. So in one provider they go to, a whole day of online learning on a medicine course that had previously been in person was still being run online, even though there were no restrictions on face-to-face. And, you know, similar things where, you know, another provider, they were keeping recorded versions of online lectures because there was overcrowding on one of the campuses. And that was partly because of the examiny shambles where the university had to take on so many students. And broadly, when the panel scratched at it, there weren't sound pedagogical reasons for this. It was because there were too many students. Okay. Now, that was the pandemic, and that was the examiny shambles, Gavin Williamson, A-levels, blah, blah, blah. Perhaps more concerningly, the panel also observed that managing increasing demand for space generally, caused by increases in student recruitment, then ended up linked to permanent shifts to online delivery. And broadly, the panel's view was you've got to make those decisions based on pedagogy rather than student number growth. Now, it's a bit late for that. might be quite difficult to turn the clock back, in, certainly in terms of PGT, international PGT, at that, I would say. But nevertheless, the line in the sand is OFS is likely to have compliance concerns. This is the phrase you get a lot in there, in relation to B1, if factors like limited physical learning resources drive decisions about how a course is delivered. And again, back on that coherence question, if a course is re-timetabled because there's not appropriate access to the in-person teaching spaces that certain subjects or skills require, that may indicate the course is not coherent. Now, there are a number of students experiencing probably on this definition right now, a lot of them PGT, a lot of them international, incoherence. So, you know, there's empowering sticks here that reps and officers and so on can use. Same sort of stuff on here. OFS would have compliance concerns if a cohort of students hasn't got access to appropriate physical resources sufficient for the purposes of a decent HE experience. That would be particularly likely, that OFS being concerned, if the absence of physical resources is linked to increases in student recruitment. Okay, there we go. Now, so that's expansion. Communication. So the panel turns up to one place and finds that students were being given a choice between face-to-face or blended. And OFS was quite pleased with that. That's good. So even though it might have been promised it would all be face-to-face, students have got more choice. Great news. Okay. However, panel observed that some providers had communicated to students a ratio face-to-face and online. And they thought that potentially oversimplified blended learning. In some cases, the boundary between in-person and face-to-face was blurred. It is face-to-face. It's just the faces on a screen. And broadly, what it was getting at here was, if you read consumer protection law, providers are supposed to ensure that applicants have clear information about the approach that will be adopted at course level. So not every single hour of every single module, but it basically needs to be pretty clear. You know, they need to understand the approach. And here's why. So what they do in the doc is they pull out the aspects of the guidance on consumer protection law that universities in England are required to pay due regard to, which is the 2015 Competition and Markets Authority guidance. And there are two really important things in that guidance that relate to this that are in the orange boxes on the screen now. So the law makes it unlawful to mislead students by failing to give them the information they need to make an informed decision. And the information in the informed decision is called material information. Material information is stuff that's material to their decision making. And then the type of information should include composition of the course and how it will be delivered, balance between various elements, expected workload of students, locations, and so on. It's pretty hard to read that and say, we will say to students from time to time, some of their stuff may be online and some of it may not. You've got to be a bit more detailed than that. You've got to be clear with students. You know, what kind of balance of online, offline, and so on there ought to be. And once a provider says that, makes the promise, in other words, you know, OFS is saying the guidance says you have to make clear promises. And once you make clear promises, you have to deliver on clear promises. That's consumer protection law. Make the right promises, deliver on the promises. Okay. Again, some people might be sat there thinking, not sure that's really how it's panned out. That whole thing about delivering what was promised, sort of talked on many of the catch-up calls, I guess, about demand smoothing and class sizes and making changes to courses and so on. But in theory, that's the thing that OFS is reminding people there. Now, some other issues. First is this thing about on-campus teaching. So this is quite interesting, I think. So there's this assumption that, you know, digital learning will all be done in the home. And of course, actually, for lots of students, it doesn't work like that, or they don't have the relevant software at home, or, you know, they're just on campus during the day or whatever it might be. And what happened was during the inspection-y process with the clipboards, a bunch of students said to the kind of clipboard warriors, it's really hard to find somewhere on campus where we can engage with the digital teaching and learning resources, which was fascinating. So that is interesting. So what the panel has argued there is that's a coherence issue. Again, back to coherence from the point of view of timetabling of blended learning courses. Providers should consider, this is the academic judgment, how students engage with online elements of their course while they are physically on campus. That kind of points to something slightly wider, I think, which is, I do speak to lots of people who in the sector who obsess about how students engage with the formal hours of teaching, but perhaps don't really ever think about the entire rest of the week. And obviously the rest of the week or even the rest of the day really matters to students, particularly given students have got much more complicated lives these days. So, as I say, The academics took the view that providers need to think about how students engage with that stuff when they're on campus. As I say, the panel was kind of worried about that. The view was that providers ought to think about that stuff while they're on campus. And there's a few examples here. So at one place, students said there just wasn't anywhere to sit and do that. Some students felt the issue was compounded by there being more online lectures and were kind of surmising that, you know, even if they tried, they couldn't fit them all on campus these days. And broadly, OFS was saying, look, if you think back to B2, if because there's a lack of suitable facilities on campus, a group of students, a cohort of students can't participate in online learning, when they're on campus, that's a problem. Okay. So that goes from a student moan to a regulatory compliance issue. If you've got evidence of it, if reps are talking about that and so on. So important that you talk to course reps, therefore, about this kind of thing. Again, related to this, so OFS says in the B2 guidance that having consistent access to an appropriate place to study is an example of digital learning resources for the purposes of B2. Generally, OFS would have compliance concerns if a provider required students to spend a significant proportion of their time engaging in digital learning without ensuring they had access to space that allowed them to do it. Can't just assume that digital learning is something you don't have to provide space for. In fact, the opposite. Providers are required, in the context of their students, to consider the space needs on campus for students to engage in digital teaching and learning. You know, a great thing for reps to know, for officers to talk about in committee meetings, and so on. As I say, because of the kind of rather lazy assumption from some people in the sector that if it's digital, you don't have to worry about there being enough space to kind of do it on campus. Related issue, kind of adjacent to that, learning resources. So on this one, the panel kind of came across the ways in which some providers were providing extra support. So, you know, this is things like, you know, digital poverty stuff. This is things like laptop loans, bursaries, digital skills training, support from learning technologists. I think there's something going on at Greenwich where there's a fantastic sort of student-led tech ambassador scheme where they sort of train students up in the tech to train other students. They pay them, but you know, worth checking out at Greenwich. They did an event there last year where there was a student ambassador for this scheme who was talking quite vividly about how proud they were to kind of learn how to do this stuff and pass it on to other students. But the panel found when it was going around these six providers that some students were unaware of the resources. Maybe they didn't need them. Who knows? But here's the relationship then from the panel's stuff to OFS considerations. So this is the OFS doc. So, for example, loaning students laptops might be a good way to provide students with access to digital content, but it might not be enough on its own. OFS would certainly take things into account, but it would look at all of the kind of learning resources and support in the round for a cohort of students. And broadly, if a group of students hasn't got access to sufficient hardware and infrastructure to access the digital content on their course, particularly if it was blended, OFS would be likely to have regulatory compliance concerns. Similarly, if students weren't offered the opportunity to develop the skills they needed to use the tech. Okay. Now, again, and this pivots a little bit off from resources, this is also helpful because you'll notice I talked a couple of times about appropriate to the cohort. What the panel said when it was doing the clipboard stuff was, thing is, if a provider is doing a blended learning thing and hasn't thought about students with different characteristics, particularly disabled students, because, you know, there's this lazy assumption that disabled students are all going to benefit. Actually, there are some disabled students who will find online learning much, much harder to access for all sorts of reasons. The panel's general view, and again, you know, you can remix this out away from the blended learning conversation into a more general set of expectations. But just to say, the panel's view was providers ought to be working with students to understand their needs, particularly disabled students, to improve the accessibility of blended courses. Absolutely. I think we can all get on board with that. So, for example, third bullet down, panel found that students on some courses reported really quite poor experiences of live lectures being dual cast, staff sort of moaning to students that hybrid delivery didn't work for their subject, and so on and so on. But broadly, OFSC's view on all of that was, you've got to consider the resource and support needs of the cohort, particularly from a disabled student point of view. A cohort of students with a range of academic needs would result in a provider needing to take more or more substantial steps to ensure sufficient resources. Now, I don't know, there might be a course rep that says, well, I don't think my provider on my module even tries to understand the different needs on my course. That would be a regulatory concern for OFS. Okay. So, you know, it's relatively straightforward, this. There's a lot of words on this slide, but it's pretty straightforward, this. You've got a group of students, take steps to understand their needs, both from a student characteristics point of view and also a kind of, you know, academic needs point of view, deliver for them, pay particular notice on reasonable adjustments with disabled students because that's the law. Now, I'll rattle through the kind of final few. There's a few in there on lectures and guest speakers. I won't talk too much about guest speakers. We'll send these slides out. I'll just kind of leave this slide up. Broadly, the panel found all sorts of concerns about guest speakers on some programs. Move on from that. One that came up in a few places was students, when the panel were going around, were saying, is it legit to reuse last year's lectures? Now, OFS has sort of hedged its bets here along with the panel and said, look, if nothing has changed since last year, you know, it might be fine. If you look at that first bullet, in some cases, content will remain relevant across years. The panel's view, though, was you got to make sure that stuff's still up to date. And reused lecture recordings may include inaccurate deadlines or administrative information from previous years. you can just imagine what they had to sit through, wouldn't you, to kind of get around to writing that down. So that relates to B1, course has to be up to date. It relates to B2. Support for students on the organisation and management front, because if there was, you know, 10 minutes at the end of the lecture that said, gave all the wrong deadlines for an essay, that would be incorrect and confusing administrative information and would cause OFS concerns under B2. Okay, so B1, course has to be up to date. B2, support for students, don't confuse them with the wrong info. Okay. Bit different to that, but kind of related, was online lecture quality. So the panel basically, I mean, I'd love them to have kind of done a little compilation album, really. It would be great to do a little kind of clip show. But you read it, but basically the panel had to sit through, you know, online lectures where someone was pointing at a whiteboard that was out of shot. The sound quality was shot. It was terrible. Some sessions were too long. And I mean, it's, you know, you can guess where this fits, can't you? We're in B1 country here on teaching quality. And B2 is poor quality resources. So B2 is about resources to support students, a concern. B1, the teaching itself, a concern. OFS would have concerns if online lecture quality is ropey. And then related to that is staff skills. So obviously one of the things that you need in order to kind of do decent stuff in the previous couple of slides is you need staff that kind of know what they're doing, are kind of taught to use the tech, are being supported to use the tech. The panel found in some cases there had been good efforts to upskill staff. In some cases, the panel did not find that. So, you know, here's a good example. On a performing arts course, second bullet list, the panel described digital developments in the creative arts sector, which had been integrated into a course. Jolly well good. Troubles all round. Good stuff. But in some cases, didn't find that kind of good stuff. Now, by the time you get this far into the document, you're like, I mean, is there really that much of a link to blended learning, or are you just kind of going through all the aspects of what a good course looks like? But give you an example. One of the things the panel found was when everything was happening online, students couldn't get helpful feedback or academic assistance. So what was happening was students didn't feel like they could ask for help in an online session, and then they would email their lecturer and it would take a week to get back to them. Whereas, you know, if they were in a face-to-face class, they'd have put their hand up and they'd have gone and seen the lecturer at the end of the session. And there's this idea in the doc about the learning moment passing. You don't want to let the moment pass, which I think is quite interesting and powerful. Anyway, one of the places students said that online delivery meant that, for example, they weren't getting good feedback on the mathematical elements of the course. And that was partly because the chat function didn't allow them to write complex formulas down. Fascinating. Another provider, students said that during the pandemic, teaching staff increased their contact through email, and that was very helpful. The implication being, of course, that is not a universal experience. And certainly talking to many officers over the summer, that has not been a universal experience in terms of people getting back to students. And students being able to access that kind of dialogue, I think, the kind of backwards and forwards that you get in, you know, in the right sized class. Again, this relates to B2. Students getting, this isn't assessment feedback, but students getting feedback from academics and being supported by academics, that needing to be happening. And if it's not happening, finding ways to cause it to happen. Now, a few kind of straggler issues then towards the end. One is, this is really interesting. I mean, you know, I know we've gone on a bit here, but this is really interesting. So students and staff are in the panel, in some cases, reported really low attendance and engagement. Now, I know, talking to many of you, that this has been a concern at lots of universities. And what the panel did was they tried to identify a difference. I mean, it's not that easy practically, but a difference between attendance and engagement. So attendance, is the student there, and engagement, are they participating? Now, clearly people have got theories about the kind of impact of the pandemic in the long term. But nevertheless, you know, lots of people have been very concerned about that. Panel was very concerned about that. The panel found one course for which students, this is brilliant, for which students reported attendance rates below 50% for in-person elements of the course, and that many students had left the course. And the student said, so anyway, about February, March, a lot of the students became disinterested and they lost their motivation to do the real work. Maybe 10 to 15 students at a time in those tutorials. It's not exactly enough. Whether it was the fact that the university struggled at the start of the year or whether it was post-pandemic stress, we don't know, but the motivation just wasn't there. And the panel basically looked at it and thought, well, hold on, the course is providing a lot of online teaching here. And students said that had led to an increased emphasis on theory-based learning rather than practical stuff. That meant less interaction, less engagement. The cycle of kind of boredom and disengagement ramps up and you end up where you are. So the, what the case study does it suggests that decisions about the delivery method for a course can be linked to low attendance and non-continuation. The reason I think that's so important, those of you that are doing the TEF student submission, how on earth do we write about B3? There's a great example of where that panel went in, talked to a group of students and found that decisions about the delivery method were linked to low attendance and non-continuation. In other words, students had theories that were that looked pretty sound about why it was that students were dropping out. That's a B1 concern because the course isn't effectively designed and delivered. And then the B2 concern is that once you get a pattern of low attendance, really what a university ought to be doing is sitting down and working out why. The way OFS frames that as a B2 concern at the bottom is the provider should have taken all the steps it could and should have taken after a pattern of low attendance to ensure students received sufficient resources and support as relevant to their academic needs. Okay. So you get a pattern of low attendance, you're supposed to then go and engage with students. They will, you know, and so on. So as I say, I think that's quite interesting from that sort of student submission. How do we talk about B3 point of view? Quickly on independent study, content overload. We've got a bit of an overlap with some stuff that we covered a little bit earlier on. The panel was quite concerned about content overload and supporting students to develop independent learning skills. You've got a B1 concern if there's too much to get through. You've got a B2 concern if providers aren't supporting students with timetable management challenges, it says there. And then three more issues that come up. One, digital learning support for students. Again, we sort of covered that a few slides back when we were looking at digital learning resources. Being part of a blended community. So B1 says that a course that is predominantly taught through large-scale lectures, online or not, without providing opportunities for small group teaching would raise compliance concerns. It also says in relation to PGR students, failing to provide opportunities for structured engagement with other researchers would be a compliance concern. So, you know, but broadly what had happened here is the panel had gone in and gone and found students who were like, I just don't know anyone. You know, lots of the stuff that's in our work with Pearson this week that we've launched on belonging and community and so on. Again, OFS is basically saying, you know, that is a B1 and a B2 concern. So B1 in terms of how the course is designed and B2 in terms of support. And then another one on graduate attributes that relates to digital skills and whether or not the digital skills are up to date, are relevant, and so on. I think that will do for one day. So what next? Let me just say a few things about what we've kind of gone through then. First is that one of the things that I think is super, super interesting and really quite helpful is effectively what I've rattled through, that initial set of statements that I've kind of described in terms of what the panel found and then how OFS has kind of located that stuff inside its framework. Is again, we're talking about rights. We're talking about students' rights in terms of their education. I think that's really helpful. And what OFS is starting to do here is build this picture of what students have the right to and then what students ideally get. And they're two different things. OFS will regulate the baseline and then universities will either work together or compete or work with students or whatever to develop above the baseline. But being really clear to students what their baseline entitled to probably is really helpful. Clearly, there are potentially ways to build this into rep training. Maybe there's you want to just get them to, reps to reflect on the B conditions in general, or maybe you want to kind of do a little. You could do a review of blended learning from the perspective of some of those headline statements, and then, you know, you could retell some of the stories that are in the blended learning review that are in the OFS document, because some of them, some of them relate to these minimum conditions. There's probably also a good argument to say that students' unions ought to find ways to communicate these things to students. you know, I say to lots of people, I've said it time and time again, you know, there are lots of students' unions where you might be able to find out what your rights are when you're signing a new contract with a landlord for a house, but maybe you don't know what your educational rights are. And to be fair, they've been pretty hard to work out until now. But as OFS starts to publish more of this stuff, notwithstanding the fact that it's not very kind of user-friendly or student-facing friendly, students' unions being able to kind of talk about this stuff as, you know, this is what you are entitled to and here's how you deal with it if you're not getting it, can only, I think, be a good thing. You'll want to make sure that all the right teams in the union are briefed. So if there are different departments in the union, if you're like in the voice team, you know, it's good for the advice team to kind of know this. I'd argue it's good for this kind of stuff. It's good for lots of people to know. Certainly when we did the study tour to the Baltics and Finland a few years ago, we found, students, every student that was like, you know, a member of a committee of a club or society had to do a test on this sort of stuff. So loads of students kind of understood the kind of base minimums that were in the kind of framework of regulation for that university. And this is the sort of thing where, you know, you're going to want to make sure that lots, kind of multiple teams are briefed on this kind of thing. One of the things you might want to do, I guess, either with a kind of group of reps or school coordinators or super reps or just with SABs or whatever, is just do a bit of an audit of what it's like this year and what it was like last year. And part of that, I think, is about getting into the habit of taking those kind of descriptions of what it's supposed to be like and getting, as I said earlier, getting students to make judgments. Increasingly, strategically, can't stress this enough, more and more, this is going to be about students' unions and student reps making judgments rather than just the voice of students. So, practicing, I guess, getting into the habit internally or whatever. And then related to that, obviously, there may well be a link between all the stuff I've talked about and the TEF student submission. If nothing else, I guess, you know, lots of people might want to try to convey what students think about the blended learning provision they have had, that they are experiencing, whether it's up to snuff in relation to the kind of minimum standards, and so on. In extremis, OFS would say, if there's big chunks of your provision at your university that are not hitting the minimums, as I have described, you should consider making a notification to OFS, which is a kind of confidential tip-off to OFS that it should dig around. I remain pessimistic about the chances of student unions thinking that's a smart thing to do, but nevertheless, that's probably what OFS would say if it was on the call. And then finally, as I said, probably maybe like a course rep conference or something, maybe you want to kind of do a version of that audit of current provision internally, but maybe with the group of reps. Maybe there's a fantastic exercise to do with your course reps at the next, the course rep training or course rep conference or whatever it is that you're running this autumn. As I say, that kind of gets students into the habit, student reps in particular, gets student reps into the habit of making judgments about their programme. And getting people talking in that way, because one of the things that we are going to have to, certainly the sector will have to do eventually, is get to a point where its academics understand this framework and understand each time OFS issues a document like this that kind of remixes these sorts of standards and makes them clear. So there you go. Hope that was helpful for people. There's a much, much shorter kind of version of the stuff I've talked about as a written briefing on the sites, obviously. Slides are available. If you've got any questions, and also the links to the two main documents I've talked about, if you've got any questions about any of that, and or you want to sort of pass on and pay forward how you've been getting on, thinking about, you know, rolling this out for course reps or talking to other people in the union about it, or even talking to the university about this sort of stuff, be great to hear those stories. Do feel free, as ever, to kind of get in touch, drop us an email or a WhatsApp or whatever. There you go. Hope that was helpful. Whatever you're doing today, have a great day.